Hello friends, this is a quick whispering introduction from Ben to this week's episode. I'm being as quiet as a church mouse, well in my case a synagogue mouse, well technically in my case a smug atheist mouse sipping a flat white and a tiny avocado and toast in a little hipster mouse cafe. But I'm being that quiet because in one room I have a sleeping toddler and in another I have a sleeping, very pregnant wife. So I'm going to get in and out as quickly as I can on this message. Firstly, to say thank you to David Whitley, who is our latest Patreon donor. David is donating $5 a month to us, and that means that he is able to choose a topic for us to talk about. And the topic he has picked is the world's worst speech. He even gave us a couple of suggestions that we might look into. One is Andrew Johnson's vice presidential inaugural speech in 1865, where he got so drunk he forgot the names of the cabinet members he was railing against, and Sir Isaac Newton's only speech in the House of Commons in its entirety, which is, "Could someone close the window? I've got a draft on my back." So we're going to look forward to digging down into, I imagine, a lot of politics and business and... oh, we'll probably go back to award ceremonies, won't we? So that's a very exciting piece of bait that David's given us. If you have an idea for a topic you'd like us to do and have got a spare $5 a month kicking around, then you can head to patreon.com/worstfootforward and join us. David is our 46th patron, and if four more of you back us up with your sweet hard cash, as well as you getting a variety of very nice treats from us, you will also spur us on to the goal of turning all of our Worst Foot Forward stories into a book. Well, not all of them, otherwise that would negate the point of the podcast and would be enormous. But we'll get out the editing scalpel and red pen and turn it into a book. We'll, of course, make sure that you guys get some sneak peeks at bits and bobs of the book, and we'll help you help us by voting on things that maybe should or shouldn't be in the book and bits of artwork that might or might not make it into the book. And of course you can suggest your favourite things, but if you'd like me and Barry to do that and you have not yet supported us, now could not be a better time. Equally, now that we're in lockdown and now that I've got a bit of free time, I'm going to be spending the next couple of weeks totting up our website and trumpeting about the podcast around various bits of the podcast universe. If you're someone who loves the show but isn't able to contribute right now but would like to help us out, rating and reviewing remains as ever the best way of making our podcast more visible. Or alternatively, and here's a cheeky thing I've not asked you to do for a while, if you're banged up at home with friends, loved ones, or indeed enemies, if they leave their phone hanging about, open up their podcatcher, find Worst Foot Forward, and hit subscribe. Every new pair of ears is very helpful and useful to us. As ever, if you want to get in touch, we're on at Worst Foot on Twitter. I'm at Ben Vanderveld. He's at Baz McStay. Or you can email us on at worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com. We look forward to hearing from you in a variety of mediums. But now, it's time to kick back, pop a knotted handkerchief on your head, slather yourself in suntan lotion, and get a delicious lobster tang as we all head off on this week's World's Worst Vacation.
Hello and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, where we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Barry McStay, and each week I, my co-host and our guest, propose our candidates for the title of the world's worst something. We're all going on a summer holiday. Except we aren't. We're all locked indoors, and frankly, the closest thing that passes for a holiday these days is putting a beach scene screensaver on your laptop and blasting up that Dimplex heater as far as it can go. And alongside me is the crumpled beach towel to my overly eager German tourist... It's Ben Vanderveld.
Thank you for suggesting that I have the nous and efficiency of our Teutonic holidaying chums.
Oh, no, I said you're the beach towel, I'm the German tourist.
Oh, no, but the beach towel is the German tourist's modus operandi.
Oh, I see.
You're...
it's the brains of the operation.
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely. No, what you don't know about German beach towels is that they have been specially bred to work as alarm clocks, and they wake up Germans
in
the morning
and say, "I'm just going to nick you." Basically, German beach towels are to Germans as flying carpets are to people from Persia. It's just obviously is that flying carpets look way better in Disney cartoons,
and they're able to put themselves out onto the beach without waking the tourists in the first place.
Yeah, precisely. And also, if you set like Aladdin in Bavaria, when Aladdin goes down into the cave, as well as the German beach towels, there's just like steins of beer and giant sausages and bratwurst and whatever that angry cabbage stuff is, sauerkraut. That's right. Angry cabbage.
Aladdin in Bavaria is the most white supremacist fairy tale I've ever heard.
Yeah, it absolutely is. Right, before once again we attract the wrong kind of listeners, I'd better introduce this week's guest. Our guest this week is an actor from London who also works at the Crystal Maze, although not at the moment due to, you know, everything. Although perhaps he is the only one of us still patrolling the empty corridors of the Aztec Zone, like a lost and lonely conquistador who forgot to catch the last ship back to the old world. As well as acting, he is most widely recognised for his appearance in the British version of RuPaul's Drag Race as part of the Brit crew. When he is not wearing the finest heels, eyelashes and wigs known to humankind, he is on the creative team for the multi-sensory art company Bittersweet, with whom he is currently developing, via Zoom, their next production entitled Held. He is another 21st century Renaissance man with a makeup bag to kill for. It is a name that's going to help us drag vacations through the mud whilst he's being dragged through the glitter. It's a delight to welcome to the show, Ashraf Edgebear.
Thank you, thank you. It is a delight to be here with you. I'm excited to join in.
Did you say the piece you're developing on Zoom is called Hell or Held?
Held.
Okay, because Hell is basically Zoom. As we've discovered, yeah. it's not other people, as Sartre said, it's Zoom calls.
I do have to ask, if Bittersweet is a multi-sensory arts company, when I go and enjoy art, I tend to do it with my eyes and my ears, so that leaves my nose, my taste buds, and my nerve endings. How do you entertain people using those last three?
Well, you... quite often we would take away the sight and blindfold you. Then we'd find manifold ways to stimulate your other senses. Or constructive to music. Stimulate sounds like the wrong word, but that is exactly what it is.
It's part, yeah. Part arts company, part kidnap gang.
Exactly. Yeah.
I like it. It's like if... ISIS went into business with a perfumier.
Sure.
Yes, I mean, you know, ISIS were one of the sort of standard bearers for the full immersive experience.
Mate, considering what their flag is like, I feel like standard bearer is a real poor choice of words.
That's very back of the fag packet, isn't it? The ISIS, yeah. Flag. That was, we founded a caliphate. Jesus, Eddie Izzard said you need a flag, and we haven't got...
I don't think ISIS have got Eddie Izzard's full back catalogue. I mean, obviously, live at the Ambassadors before he came out as trans, fine. But after that, I reckon they probably went off him pretty sharpish.
Shall we get... before we get down to, you know, business, we do have to ask Ashraf, as we do all of our guests, what are you worst at in the world? You're clearly good at strutting your stuff in various degrees of clothing and sensory excitation. What are you not so good at?
Thank you. I feel like what I'm not good at is probably a common thing that you've heard many times before, but I am... terrible at being on time. Even in this age of lockdown, you know, I have all the time in the world, but I'll still manage to be 5 minutes late, rushing to get even just to my laptop and being like, whoa, oh, I've had all this time, but I manage to fill it with random stuff and I'm still rushing. And I also get completely, completely stressed by rushing, but I take no efforts to be on time and alleviate that stress.
You definitely
I'm a glutton for it.
You definitely have one of the more laid back sort of approaches to life. I've had conversations with you where you're like stressed at work, but like Ashraf stressed is still just like sitting and chilling and like, it'll be fine. It'll work itself out.
It's true. Like, do you know, I like in the beginning of the day, if I'm late for something, you know, I could still be in the shower and then I'll completely forget that I'm late because I'm still running at the same time as I would if I had all the time in the world. I just don't step it into the gear of like, run. I just quickly be like, oh, I'm going to be late. I'm stressed by this. I'm still going to do everything as gently as I would otherwise.
Yeah.
Well, that's it. Is it, are you late because you have no concept of how time works? Or are you late because you're like, I need to prioritize me time over anyone else time?
No, I basically, if I have 5 minutes where I could be somewhere early, I'll think of what could I do with this time. I just do more with it until I'm like, oh, now I'm 2 minutes late.
You're the reason there is a Starbucks and a Pret on every street in London for the people who are 5 minutes early who just need to waste some time waiting for a mochaccino.
Yes, you have me to thank for that. I'll take credit for the Pret, but not the Starbucks.
Yeah.
They did that themselves.
This week we are talking about the world's worst vacation at the bequest of one of our noble Patreon donors, Valerie Croft. Thank you, Valerie. And we thought Ashraf, being a well-travelled gentleman, he would be the ideal person to go on such a trip with. But Ben is going to lead us off. What vacations and stuff have you discovered, Ben?
So, first of all, I found something that could easily have ended up in our extra third foot episode from a couple of weeks ago, because I found out yet another hermit that people went on vacations to go and visit. So this is a chap called Robert Harrell, who was otherwise known as the Fort Fisher Hermit. It's quite a sad life. His son committed suicide and he was confined to a psychiatric institution, but he then escaped and decided to start a new life as a preacher. And he hitchhiked 250 miles to a place called Fort Fisher in North Carolina, where he took up residence in an abandoned wartime bunker. There's a picture of it. It looks grim. And locals and tourists stumbled across this lonely guy wandering around the salt marshes preaching his version of the word of the Lord, and they claimed it as entertainment.
And no.
Very soon, he set up something he called the School of Common Sense, which does feel like the sort of thing that James Dellingpole would have a course teaching at. It got to the peak of his fame in the 60s when he was preaching again about nature and society and the evils of the man, that he had people who would make their way there as part of a pilgrimage to Woodstock or stuff like that. At his peak, he saw nearly 10,000 people a year, and he claimed to be the second largest tourist attraction in North Carolina.
What's the first?
Oh gosh, I don't know.
What else is in North Carolina? North Carolina's got the Biltmore Mansion. It's got a national forest. Is he... Wait. And there's also a mountain. So if he's the second biggest, he's either bigger than a mountain or a forest.
Hey, he was clearly preaching some good word of the Lord there. I also took a quick look at something we talked about ages ago. I cannot remember what episode it was in, but you know how in China there is a predilection for building shit replicas of famous landmarks?
Yeah, like they have like an alpine town in the middle of China. Well, yeah. And things like that.
They have somewhere called Thames Town, which is in the Songjiang district, about 20 miles from Shanghai, and it looks like a classic British market town with cobbled streets, Victorian terraces, Tudor houses, corner shops and red telephone boxes. The reason why you can tell that it is clearly a copy, well, it's A, because it's in fucking China, but Also, is because it is pristine. It is eerie. I looked at it for a couple of minutes on the internet. I was like, what is wrong with this? There's some sort of uncanny valley thing happening. And it's because it's not filthy and there are no, like, 1.5 clawed
pigeons hobbling their way through the market square.
Some of the various places it's modelled on is Christchurch and Clifton Down in Bristol, Lyme Regis in Dorset, and Chester High Street. It's a very popular location for wedding photography.
Your special day taken outside between the Greggs and the W.H. Smiths.
Well, that's it. They haven't recreated it like, you know, a British town in the 50s or the 20s or the 1870s. It's like a current British town.
And why? It's that's so weird. It's like boarded up shop the high street that died.
Yeah. How long ago was it built? Because if like 2008 and the crash happened, did they just have to like board up a load of the shop? Did they have a Woolworths in it? Did they have to close down
that's
a Woolworths?
What I was wondering.
Yeah, they must have to keep updating. Yeah, no, I really hope it is now just like a pound shop, then a betting shop, then a pound shop, then a betting shop.
I really wanted to have like a Northern Rock and a Zavvy.
Yeah, and you know, a wisecracking big issue seller and like a homeless guy with a beautifully rendered poem that makes you think twice before walking past him. I mean, not me, but you know, I'm speaking for the average Brit on the street.
There's a great tangent, but there's a great big issue seller outside Blackheath train station an awful lot. Who goes, he does a sort of a Santa act when people go, big issue, thank you. He just like, does a big hearty ho-ho-ho chuckle, which is nice.
It is nice. I mean, the big issue is a wonderful thing. And I like a good big issue seller who goes, nope, this is my job now. I'm going to treat it like a proper job. And when I used to be a charity fundraiser, there was a guy in, it's either Portsmouth or Southampton. You just couldn't be on his pitch. No, I should point out, you couldn't be on his pitch because he was impossible to compete with.
Like,
he was like a sort of stand-up comedian, town crier and carnival barker all rolled into one. And the thing was, he had so much twinkly charm. I'm like, what did you do to end up on the streets? Because I would employ you in a heartbeat, mate. But he must have used his powers for ill. The reason I brought out...
Was he Ipswich's second favourite tourist attraction?
Yeah. Yeah, he must have been.
10,000 people would come for miles to see him.
How annoyed would you be, though, if you wanted to like shun society and you wandering around the marshes of North Carolina and suddenly 10,000 people a year are coming? That's more people than I see in a year.
Yeah, God, imagine wanting to be a hermit but being cursed with charisma.
It's like a magnet, like meeting both ends of it, like repelling itself.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like, my problem is, like, I walk into a state and everyone just knows I'm there. I talked about Thamestown because there was in 1920 sort of it's opposite. In 1920s, Chinatown in San Francisco was unique and exotic and exciting. However, some of the denizens of Chinatown there, and indeed in other Chinatowns around America, believe that they can make some quick cash by pandering to racist stereotypes as a way to entertain tourists. So they would add oriental features onto the buildings, like fine little sort of curly-whirly bit on the edge of a roof, but they even mocked up fake opium dens and gambling halls in which they displayed captured white women in cages and hired tour guides to spin stories of the wicked Orient to their guests.
I tell you what, though, a fake opium den is a brilliant front for a real opium den.
Well, I'd love it if instead maybe it's just like it's a fake opium den and then you go through like a bootleg whiskey place and at the back it's just a library for some people who want quiet time.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it? I mean, obviously horrendously racist, but great. I found a number of families who I consider absolutely deplorable. Amongst them is this family that I read about, a Canadian family of eight embarked on a 9,300-mile run in 2011. Even though six of the family members had never completed more than a 5-kilometre race, they each took turns logging miles with the rest of their relatives who recharged in an RV that was stocked with 65 pairs of running shoes, 120 pairs of socks, and a 10-pound tub of organic peanut butter that I presume was just constantly replenished. They jogged from Vancouver to Newfoundland.
Did they confuse peanut butter with Vaseline?
Yeah.
I hope it was smooth rather than crunchy.
Yeah, I hope so as well. Yeah, there'd be nothing more ironic than trying to stop your nuts getting raw than by rubbing nuts all over them.
One of the kids in the family was quoted as saying that they often visited schools to share their message of health, and one of them explained, "I like to be an example for kids my age. I reckon what actually happened is they turned up with this bullshit sanctimonious message and the family just got run out of town by other kids."
Just encouraged them to keep running.
Yes. I got one thing to tell you about before my choice. I found out about an airline that was proposed in Melbourne, Australia in 2003. And it sought to build on the success of companies like EasyJet and Ryanair to create long-haul, low-fare operations using a couple of dry-leased Boeing 747s. And they were going to be called the Backpackers Express. And they had proposed destinations to Delhi, Bangkok, Munich and Manchester. And the company shut down 2 years later before conducting a single flight. Firstly, the timing couldn't have been worse because the Iraq war and SARS had decimated some of the aviation industry. But also, their business model is fucking nuts. They tried to attract backpackers for these flights and claimed that on their Boeing 747s, they would fit them out with live entertainment and a pub.
Oh. The air crew would be encouraged to socialise with the passengers.
No.
Here's the worst bit.
Indigenous Australians would fly along to provide information on their culture as part of the entertainment. Before they organised anything else, they had agreed an in-principle agreement with Carlton and United Breweries to be the airline's official brewery.
And neighbours actor Ryan Maloney, who would appear in its advertising.
I've always thought it was weird the way football teams had like an official chocolate bar. I think an airplane having an official brewery maybe tops it.
Yeah. They tried to sell it as going, hey, it's going to be great. It's going to be a party in the sky. To which almost everyone went, guys, it's 2.5 years since 9/11. Now is not the time for a party in the sky.
Like, the last thing you want to do with people from your hostel is then be trapped 30,000 feet in the air with them. At least you can leave a hostel and go to the nice beach nearby.
You know, guys, last year I was flying to Athens and it took us a while to take off. But then once we were in the air, I remember it took us we landed way past the time that we were meant to land. And then when we were there on the tarmac, we were told that there was an issue with us disembarking, or we thought it was a technical issue. But we ended up staying on the plane for another hour and a half, 2 hours. And then we left, passed by all this security, and had to have everything searched. And we didn't find out until we then got to Athens that when our flight was in the mid-air, they got a warning that our flight was going to be hijacked. And so this would have been a terrible thing to know. But we just thought, I remember thinking, wow, security is really tight in Greece. But it was literally because they thought that there was a bomb on our plane.
Jesus.
So they let you take off because they were like, we think they're going to get hijacked. No. But obviously,
I think they thought something was going to, but it wasn't until we were in the air that they got some kind of intel that it was our plane.
Wow. You started that story and I went, oh, maybe the airline went bust while you were in midair or something. You had to land at the wrong airport, but no, it took a darker turn than I anticipated.
A full-on bomb scare that none of us knew about. And while we were on the plane, that would have been a lot worse.
I mean, I would like, if I was ever going to hijack a plane, I would double bluff the fuck out of them in that I would dress as Wile E. Coyote and then walk aboard the plane whilst holding a box marked Acme, do not open. And just see if anyone would call me on it.
Yeah, but you see, the clever roadrunner who was sitting in the seat behind you would have painted a hole in the floor of the plane under your seat. And you'd have fallen straight through it and saved the day.
The roadrunner, such a shill of airport safety and security.
Here's a question. Why, if we have life jackets on airplanes, why don't we have parachutes on boats?
Barry, some 1990s Seinfeld stand-up called and he wants his jokes back.
Oh, is that a Seinfeld line? Genuinely, this occurred to me.
No, it's not. It just feels so authentically like some brick wall observational stand-up.
Fine, how was the airline food while you were on the plane, by the way, Ashran?
It was lovely. I love airplane food. I love a little metal box.
And impossible to spread butter.
Yes, and the whole jigsaw puzzle of, you know, okay, I'm gonna unpack this and put this in there.
Yeah, it's like a little game of Tetris, how you arrange your tray.
Let me tell you about the worst vacation I could find. I tried to find all sorts of different organizations that might organize a jolly, and do you know who's probably organized definitely the stupidest vacation? It's our friends at the Flat Earth International Conference. Because last year they announced their biggest, boldest adventure, and it was this. It was a cruise to sail to the ends of the earth to come up to the enormous ice wall that they believe surrounds the flat earth and prevents any of the ocean water from falling off the sides.
And
I'm genuinely, like, obviously this is bonkers, but I'm also really glad to know that they think there's a wall around the earth, because that's a fact I didn't know. I mean, it's not a fact, yeah. But yeah, it's the thing I didn't know.
Because I thought that, you know, if you did believe that there was a gushing waterfall at the end, it would make sense that you would keep parachutes on your boat.
Yeah.
Oh, we're getting close to the edge. Everyone put your parachutes on.
Oh dear, Barry, you've inadvertently become a flat earther truther.
Didn't even know it.
Well, I don't know. I feel like there's going to be quite a Venn diagram crossover between flat earthers and Trump voters. And I think now they'll have changed their doctrine to say there's an ice wall around the edge of the earth to keep the aliens out.
Yeah.
But the Flat Earth Society, which claims and is proud to say that it is the oldest official Flat Earth organization dating back to the early 1800s, that's what they want to go and check out. Now, there is one catch, and it's this obvious catch. Navigational charts and systems that guide cruise ships and other vessels around the Earth's ocean are all based on the principle of a round Earth. Not only that, a chap called Henk Keye, who was interviewed for the article I read, who said, listen, had the Earth been flat, a total of 3 satellites would have been enough to provide the information to everyone on Earth to allow the cruise ships to move around. But it is not enough, because the Earth is round.
So did that mean they then had to, like, kit out a special boat and get a flat earther captain to sail it?
So, annoyingly, the journey was scheduled for this year. And conveniently for our flat earther friends, I believe COVID-19 meant it had to be called off. They would claim, I'm sure, that COVID-19 is a conspiracy by the Illuminati to stop them discovering the truth about the flat earth.
My favourite thing I remember, because we talked about the Flat Earth Society in our episode about the world's worst conspiracy theory, and the one thing I remember is that when you visit their website, they have an FAQ section, and the first question is, are you serious? And the answer is one word, yes. That's amazing. How many people had signed up to go on this cruise?
Oh gosh, that I don't know, but I mean, they're a large organisation, so I would imagine several hundred.
Yeah.
Basically, I found one article about this, and then I tried to do more research, and every other article I found was just this article regurgitated with some more Rye laughing out the side of their mouth at these idiots.
Has anyone ever seen this ice wall? Was this meant to be the first expedition
It's a really good point. So here's what they say about how Antarctica works. He says, when we look at Antarctica, if you take a globe and you squish it down, the Antarctic would go all the way around the Earth. I presume kind of like if you squish a cake down and the icing would go around the side. He says it's kind of like an ice shore, and it's not like you just go there and you can just peek over it. We don't believe anything can fall off the edge because a big portion of the flat Earth community believes that we're in a dome, like a snow globe. So the sun, the moon and the stars are all inside. It's very hard. So they've watched Simpsons the movie and have taken that a little bit too literally.
What do they think is on the bottom of the snow globe? Made in China, presumably.
They claim, so obviously when they've been challenged with early sailors who've made it there, they or indeed some people who have made the journey all the way across Antarctica, they say that explorers who've made the journey across it have just been going in circles and not realised. Even though, like, the explorers have gone, the data's on my website, you pillocks. And according to him, Captain Cook, who is the first modern explorer to have breached the Antarctic Circle, and he says he reached the ice barrier. He says he intended to sail completely around Antarctica because Captain Cook believed that the Earth is a globe. But he claims he sailed a total of 60,000 miles along the Antarctic coastline, not possible in one of those old boats. And because Cook wrote, the ice extended east and west, far beyond the reach of our sight, while the southern half of the horizon was illuminated by rays of light, which were reflected from the ice to a considerable height. So this chap believes that that is proof that what Captain Cook saw was an ice wall, not a glacier.
So this chap is happier to believe a dead guy from 250 years ago than modern science.
Indeed. And the last word, I think, should go to the cruise ship captain, Henk Kaya, who said, I have sailed 2 million miles, give or take. I have not encountered one sea captain who believes the Earth is flat. For those reasons, I believe that this aborted mission is absolutely the stupidest and worst vacation of all time.
How about we start with a holiday called Tanakoi?
Sounds lovely.
Yeah, it does sound lovely. So Tanakoi happens in Peru once a year, actually on Christmas Day, the 25th of December. And on that day, you would find dancing. You may find baby Jesus processions. But the main event of Tanakoi is a fight. Yes, it is basically, to Tanakoi actually translates to literally to hit each other. And this is a festival which is a fighting festival in which different communities, people battle out their rivalries, or, you know, if you have some kind of dispute, you would take it to Tanakoi. So you would travel to here in order to face off against your sworn enemy.
It's like Judge Judy. You know, rather than small claims court, you go to Tanakoi and just have a fight.
Judge Judy, it does sound like it could work. It's a conflict resolution in a festival. So it does sound like a great way in order to settle your disputes. In this, you would also have the fighters would wear masks, and they would sometimes change their voices, so you wouldn't know who was fighting whom until the victor sort of, you know, take the mask off like Scooby-Doo and be like, oh, I knew it was you.
I'd like the idea, though, that they have baby Jesus parades as well, because I was kind of hoping it was like they just would set baby Jesuses on each other.
I love the idea that within all of this is also baby Jesus happening, and, you know.
And baby Jesus is up on the top rope.
Jesus is the referee, isn't he? Or is he just in the middle going, I'm the Prince of Peace, lads, leave it.
Oh, I thought he'd be making, like, surprise guest appearances in the fight, you know, climbing up on the top rope and...
If he was the referee, he would be decked out with a whip, and this whip is used to hold back the baying crowds of people who circle around the fighting.
This is amazing.
As a sworn pacifist,
top of your list.
The idea of going to Tanakoi on Christmas Day, no less.
Do they then have
like a terrifying festival?
But then did they wait? What time of the day did they have the festival? Because do they have it after the Christmas dinner where everyone's had all the family arguments? And they're like, right, we're gonna settle this down at Tanakoi. Or they do it beforehand, and then they have the arguments over Christmas dinner, and they've got to wait a whole year to get around to settling it.
I would say that. You want to have that year-long drama. Gosh darn it, my neighbour. He built his fence too high. I can't wait to see him at Tanakai.
That's amazing.
On the same sort of note of a sort of holiday days, I stumbled upon one which is... I'll just tell you the story of where it comes from. So this happens in Japan and is called Kanemaru Matsuri. And so on this day, the origins of this festival. So as the story goes, there was a demon who hid inside the vagina of a young woman after falling in love with her. And
playing the long game.
Really, it was a lovely place to hide. And this demon was so filled with jealousy that when the young woman married someone else, the demon bit off the young man's penis when he tried to have sex with her. And this happened twice.
The guy had two penises.
Well, somehow. He had his spare one, and it took that one off too.
Wow.
Just carry a second. and so in order to... So she had two wedding nights, and both of this happened. So, you know, that second guy who she got married to, hats off to him. After the first one. Yeah. So a third one...
Surely helmets off.
Well, then she headed to a blacksmith, and this blacksmith helped her out.
As you do.
Her third... husband with a steel penis. So which when they had sex broke the demon's teeth and the demon exited the woman, and since then there is a festival of the steel phallus. Yes. That is this one. So it is a festival which came in and out of fashion over many hundreds of years, and then at some point it became a festival where you would pray for sexual health and to rid yourselves of STIs.
I mean, if you've got a steel penis, then the only STI you can get is rust.
No, steel is stainless. Steel isn't steel rustless.
Yeah. Sorry, you are right. And actually, something that's, you know, a stainless tool to be used during sex, perfect.
Perfect. Long lasting for your pleasure.
Riveted for your pleasure, even.
So this festival, to protect you from STIs, since the original STI was a demon hiding inside the vagina. And after many years, I think in the 70s, because it had this relationship, it ended up becoming a sort of festival about sex and about sexual freedom. But within this festival, it seems to me like this is where all of those Hindu paraphernalia ends up. People dress up as penises. There are penis-shaped lollies being handed around to the child. It is a big festival for huge steel penises.
That is amazing.
Also, interestingly though, it became a sort of queer festival in an otherwise sort of largely, I guess the idea is like Japan is quite sexually repressed would be the sort of large stereotype. But on this day, it becomes a big old celebration of penises, and there's like bouts of cross-dressing. The huge parade is filled with one particular, they have floats of penises going down, and in one of them it's carried by six men who cross-dress as women in pink kimonos, and they are the highlight of this event. So this festival has gone from some kind of steel penis defeating the demon to queer liberation.
Are they some like version of the Brit crew? They're the dick crew for that generation.
Steel Dick Crew. Exactly.
I want to go to that, and I was about to say ride one of the seal penises. I want to be on one of those floats, you know. You know the people who get to be on like the open top buses or on top of the floats at parades and St. Patrick's Day and things like that. I want to be.
I could imagine it would also be you know, children being dragged there and they desperately do not want to be there.
That's amazing. Why don't we know about this stuff?
Well, that's what the internet's there for.
I mean, I'm all for multicultural and stuff, but surely we could add in some more of these holidays. You know, we don't just have to restrict it to the religious festivals.
Yeah, I mean, I would say the strangest festivals are always the most amazing.
Yeah.
So unusual. So I did go off into a tangent when I was looking at sort of these holidays, these days, festivals. And the Kanemaru Matsuri had such an awful origin story, but has ended up being quite a lovely one. So maybe I think I went a little left field with that one.
Nice.
So let me bring you back to a place we know a little better, London.
Which London are we talking about now? London, England, or London in the middle of China for some reason?
So we're going to go for London in England because the Thames is quite important in this.
Okay.
And so this is a holiday. First of all, there was this British couple and their young kid, and they went for a day out in London. And as you do, they wanted to take in all the sights. And so they went on one of those duck boats. You know, the boats that are shaped, no, the vans that are shaped like a boat. So those ones, you go around for the day, you're looking above, and then at the sort of pinnacle of it is going down into the river, and then this van becomes a boat.
Yeah.
And so these guys were on that, and then once they were on the duck boat in the river, they start to notice that there's some smoke billowing from the front. The smoke turns out to be a fire. The whole duck boat is on fire.
Delicious.
They've previously been told that this boat is 70 years old, over 70 years old, which I found incredible that these duck boats could have existed like in the 1940s and people were just driving around and then going down into the Thames. That's remarkable.
Can you imagine being rescued from Dunkirk in a duck boat?
Like that, and maybe one of the swans from Casual News Fanstein.
Yes.
I mean, it would have been a useful tool in Dunkirk. The army should have requisitioned these duck boats.
Yeah.
You know, travel along, get onto land.
Amphibious vehicle. Your mobile going. Yeah, it's true. So plus camouflage, because the Germans aren't just going to be, it's just a duck going past. It's like a Trojan duck.
Exactly. No one will ever notice the duck.
Don't suspect the duck.
Don't suspect the duck. So for, on this ill-fated trip along the Thames, the people need to jump. They need to get into the water and swim away for their lives. But yet, they weren't even afforded that kind of glory in their scary story because it was low tide. And so when they jumped off the boat, they were waist deep in the sludge of the river, quite close to the side. So what could have been, you know, an epic story to go home and tell your family about. It's a little lackluster. Everyone makes it off the boat, but they're scarred by the memories of this duck boat trip in London.
Oh, man. It's in among the shopping trolleys and bent bicycle wheels at the bottom of the river.
Yeah, I would imagine that the most... biggest injuries would have happened being trapped in that sludge of that river.
Can you imagine being that kid going back to school, though, and you get the traditional first week at school essay of what I did on my summer holidays? The teacher going, nonsense, stop making stuff up, Timmy.
There couldn't possibly be a van that turns into a boat when it goes in the river, let alone dressed as a duck.
Is that your candidate, then?
No, my candidate is a very topical holiday, which perhaps we've all heard of. I would like to introduce you to a certain cruise called the Diamond Princess.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I don't know about this.
Oh, yes, you do. So the Diamond Princess, these people were looking forward. Well, first of all, I think the idea of cruises is a terrifying holiday.
Yeah.
Of being trapped. They're also ridiculously expensive. But I guess you do see a lot. So these people were going to travel around the coast of China, Vietnam, and Taiwan before returning to Japan. It would have been a two-week pleasure cruise around this area. But there was a little-known virus that had emerged, and it so turned out that Diamond Princess would soon become the second most infected area in the world after China for the coronavirus.
Oh, yeah.
And so I feel like it makes it a little bit worse. Someone disembarked from the cruise in Hong Kong and then 5 days later found out that they had coronavirus. Mm. So that person, the original patient zero of the cruise, wasn't even on it anymore. So the cruise ends up being docked back at their original port in Yokohama in Japan, pretty much close to the end of their trip. But they are told that they must wait on the boat, and they end up being on the boat for 3 more weeks than they intended. What turned out to be 2 weeks became 5 weeks, trapped inside their small rooms. And cruise boats are tiny rooms.
Yeah. Yeah.
While this virus spread throughout the boat.
And you're not allowed to use the swimming pools or the cinemas or the bowling alleys or whatever they have on this thing.
No, completely in those tiny rooms, because the whole idea of a cruise is that you have this entire huge boat that you could travel around and you're never really in your rooms.
Yeah.
To be trapped there, and they were left there while, and they actually think now that that was a misgiving, which allowed way more people to get infected than not. But on the upside, they were offered a full refund for their trip.
Oh, well, that's all right then.
Free meals. And somehow Amazon deliveries were still able to forget them in their room. Which is absolutely testament to the incredible capitalist nature of Jeff Bezos, that on this quarantine ship, you can still get your Prime delivery.
You got a drone that's not just landing on deck, but is like navigating the deck map, going to the right floor, flying down the corridor, somehow knocking on your door.
Yes. Exactly.
That's amazing.
So at least Amazon was able to make some kind of benefit out of this situation.
Wow.
And the cruise, what would you call the people on the cruise? The cruise customers?
Cruisers.
The cruises. The cruisers were offered a free cruise in the future, but I'm not sure any of them would be in a hurry to get back onto.
My husband's really keen on the idea of going on a cruise, and I'm not.
Oh, it sounds horrible. Like, even without the coronavirus, it sounds horrible.
Well, part of my misgivings are the fact that, you know, if there's an emergency, you need to evacuate. The people in charge of evacuating you are the entertainers, the musical theatre dancers who are off on their year cruise around the world. They're the ones who are, like, directing you to the emergency exits and helping you into your lifeboats and all of that stuff. I don't want someone whose main skill is to be able to count the offbeat to be the person who's ensuring that I'm wearing my life jacket the right way around.
That's exactly the person I want to be having. I mean, the people on Titanic, it was those people playing the fiddle that were the best people when it was going down.
That's true. So, yeah, they might give us a great version of All That Jazz as the ship is sinking, at least. I read a bit about the holiday locations of various world leaders. Castel Dan Gandolfo, that's the palace where the Pope can go on holidays, if they like. It's about 25 kilometres outside of Rome, because Rome was built on very swampy ground. So emperors and popes and all sorts are always leaving Rome during the summer months to try and avoid, you know, the mosquitoes and the cholera and all the different various outbreaks that might occur. So they had this apostolic palace at Castel Gandolfo, which Pope Francis has only visited a few times and has never spent a night, apparently. And so instead he's opened it up as a museum, so you can go and visit it if you wanted to do that. One of the features there is the swimming pool, which Pope John Paul II had installed, and he was subsequently photographed in his swimming trunks by paparazzi by the swimming pool.
That's incredible. I mean, I was about to say, is nothing sacred?
And imagine being the paparazzi who got that snap, and the guy who got the snap of, I don't know, Princess Diana at the opening of some film in a lovely dress, and you're competing for the front of Hello magazine.
I just can't believe that the Pope goes swimming topless. Was he at least wearing his skull cap?
You would hope so. Presumably he just, you know, puts his hands out to the side and the water immediately parts. There's lots of... You'll all have heard of Mar-a-Lago, where Trump goes and spends a lot of his holiday time, and he's been pushing the idea of it as the winter White House. There have been lots of something White Houses down the years. Nixon used to go to a place called Key Biscayne in Miami, which he called the Florida White House, and he helped upgrade it, or rather the taxpayers of America helped upgrade it to the tune of $625,000, and also paid more than $1 million to improve his Pacific mansion as well. Franklin Delano Roosevelt used to visit Warm Springs in Georgia for the therapeutic waters to help treat his polio, his paralysis. And he liked the place so much that he bought it. And he built a little one-story cottage in the grounds of this Warm Springs resort, which he called the Little White House, which is what apparently Truman also called the duplex apartment he had in Key West in Florida. He also called it the Little White House. And President George W. Bush and Laura Bush used to go to Prairie Chapel Ranch in Crawford in Texas, which they referred to as the Western White House during his presidency. Things that they would like to do while there: Bush would like to go cycling along the motorbiking along the 40-mile network of bike trails. And another thing he would do on his vacations, he would clear brush from the ranch and encourage his aides to join him doing it, even in its searing heat.
Because no one's going to say no thank you, Mr. President, to that.
Yeah, exactly so. And you know, the famous place that presidents go for their breaks is Camp David. Do you know what its original name was?
Camp Goliath?
Goliath.
So close. Actually, I'm going to put that down to the internet connection and nothing else.
I went on a date with a guy called Camp Goliath.
Yeah.
No, it used to be called Shangri-La. FDR, as part of the New Deal, like in rejuvenating the American economy, one of the things they did was they built lots of forest camps and holiday camps in the Catoctin Mountains in Maryland, where Camp David is. And FDR basically selected one of those to have as the president and named it Shangri-La. About a decade later, Dwight Eisenhower renamed it Camp David after his grandson. You've gone from Shangri-La, this mystic place, to named after, I don't know, some snotty 12-year-old.
Yeah.
Winston Churchill described it as, in principle, a log cabin with all the modern improvements.
Yeah, wow. Old Winston was harsh on TripAdvisor, wasn't he?
Yeah. Gallipoli, no stars, wouldn't come back. Then I read about people who were on holiday during war.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I read about this amazing lady who I'd never heard of called Nona Baldwin Brown. She was one of the first women to have a byline in the New York Times. She was a pioneer of journalism. She graduated with a master's degree from Columbia School of Journalism, joined New York Times in 1940 and stayed there for about 35 years as part of the Washington Bureau. But before she started her career, she graduated from Vassar College and went travelling in England and Germany and Switzerland and France in the summer of 1939. And her vacation came to an end on September the 3rd when Britain and France declared war on Germany. And so she had to gather. Apparently there were thousands of Americans doing that, gathering outside the outlets of various shipping companies in Europe, trying to get a ticket backed onto a ship to go back to the US. She was one of those, apparently, who got on board the SS Washington, along with members of the Kennedy family, as in John F. Kennedy's family. And she documented her trip. It's great. You can see some of the photographs of her waiting around. Some of the most interesting photos are of like people lining up for the way back, and luggage being processed, and people milling around on deck. But there are photos before the ship set sails of the ship being painted with American flags all over it, to indicate that there was a neutral vessel, to stop it being torpedoed or anything.
Oh, wow. So basically that chip was doing the equivalent of what audience members do when they turn up a few minutes late for a comedy show, just going, nothing to see here, nothing to see here, leave me alone, leave me alone, leave me alone.
Basically that. And I also found some stories of people, you know, the way they talk about how the summer of 1914 before World War One was meant to be beautiful. It's like it's the end of the Belle Epoque, and apparently that, you know, long summer evenings and cricket and the weather was unlike any you'd seen before. I found a postcard sent on the 29th of July from Brussels to Middelkerke. Is the weather as bad on the seaside as here in Brussels? It has been cold for over a week and raining every day. Have you heard any word of war? Here, every conversation touches on it. Thank you for your cards. You must have found Newport different, especially the corner by the chalet. Have you gone swimming? Please thank Lulu for her card. We give her a kiss. Sincerely, Louise and Anatole. Louise and Anatole sent that from Brussels on the day that the Belgian Prime Minister Charles de Broqueville ordered a partial mobilisation of the army, because within a week Belgium was at war.
There's something, I mean, obviously the horror of all this, you know, never such innocence again, but just occasionally you look at this and go, you naive fools.
Yeah, I also like this story. Adolf Hamby, who was a solicitor in Mons, he left on a vacation to Westend with his entire family, children, stepchildren and grandchildren, some servants, 42 cases of baggage on the 31st of July. That's 2 days after that postcard was sent. Imagine having, like, not only that much, 42 cases of luggage, but also children, stepchildren and grandchildren having to turn them all around again at the start of the invasion. Westend, where they were going to go to, was the place where then loads of holidaymakers were then replaced by refugees, because everyone fled to the coast to try and get boats over the channel to Britain.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. I read about some of the holiday destinations of Roman emperors as well. Hadrian's villa at Tivoli, it's about the size of a small town, was crammed with a lot of the sculptures you see around European museums. They're all dug up from Hadrian's villa. Like, a lot of the Roman art all came from there. He had loads of art and stuff. But he also did what the Chinese that you mentioned did, Ben. He recreated some famous tourist sites in the grounds of the villa, and his favourite one apparently was a replica of the Temple of Aphrodite at Knidos in Turkey. Which was, he made a little miniature version of it at home. It had a famous naked statue of the goddess Aphrodite, apparently the first ever without any sort of modest clothing. And he liked it so much that he didn't want to sail to Turkey to see it. He built a copy of it in his holiday home.
I like all these guys who are so influenced by Remington Steele. I like the company so much, I bought it myself. It's the same sort of thing as going, I liked this holiday destination so much, I
built it myself.
The other famous place Roman emperors would go to was the island of Capri, which was basically owned by the emperor. It was, you know, it had 12 imperial residences on the island and a beautiful blue grotto, which is sort of a cave you can sail into. But not only was it, you know, Roman, the property of the emperor, but there was no natural water on it as well. So they went to huge lengths to make it habitable. They built these industrial size water tanks to capture the rainwater to make it possible for them to stay there. But there was one residence there called the Villa Jovis, or the Villa of Jupiter, where apparently if someone displeased the emperor, it was built on a cliffside so they could just shove them over the cliff. And Suetonius, who wrote a biography of Tiberius, the Roman emperor, who basically gave up being emperor and just stayed on Capri for the rest of his life, he had lots of fun by getting his male guests to drink loads of wine and then putting ligatures around their dicks so they couldn't piss. And swam in his swimming pool with boys that he nicknamed Little Fishes, whose job was to swim between his legs and nibble at his genitals. An early version of those things you get in the shopping centres of the fish baths for your feet. I don't know, do we say different times? but I'm coming to my choices for the world's worst holiday. And I looked at, I did find one disastrous holiday. A Chinese woman who was on a staycation in her own country She was from the Jiangxi province, and she went to visit the Yunnan province near the border with Myanmar, where a lot of the jade in China is from. And she was in a shop examining a jade bracelet, and she was told the price, and she thought that's a bit too expensive. She couldn't afford it, so she took it off and dropped it, and it broke in two. The bracelet was priced at $44,000 or £35,000. Shop staff tried to calm her down, but she was so panicked she turned pale, began sweating, and fainted, which is captured on video. She came round apparently after other customers who'd rushed to help her pinched her under her nose.
That's incredible. It's like an antiques roadshow moment.
Yeah, it really is, isn't it? But I read about dumb places to go on holiday and vacations. Australia has a habit of having big things. You know the way that, like, the whole joke about the biggest ball of twine in the world or the biggest chair, all these things. In Australia, in 1963, you could visit the Big Scotsman, a 5 metre tall novelty Highlander in a kilt and puke green jacket in Adelaide. It was then followed by the Big Dinosaur in Somersby and the Big Banana at Coffs Harbour. Sounds like that could have been repurposed and sent to that festival in China that Ashraf was telling us about. Queensland has the Big Pie, the Big Peanut, and the Big Paperclip.
Oh, I was about to say a three-course dinner.
Yeah.
But no.
And you can go to visit in Kalgoorlie in Western Australia, the Big Dustbin, or in Robertson, New South Wales, the Big Potato.
Hang on, so they've got a big dustbin and a big paperclip. Are they trying to just make an enormous Microsoft Word desktop?
Possibly. They may also be branching out into emojis, because in Kiama, New South Wales, you've got the big poo. This is a country, of course, which does have the big Great Barrier Reef, of course. You could go see that instead. You can visit Hell, Michigan, which has very much leaned into its name. Hell, okay. In Michigan in the US has a college called Damnation University, where you can get certificates from. The high street store has death certificates and scorched postcards. And you can go on the mini golf course, which is modelled on Satan's house. And not only that, you can go to a gelato parlour called Scream's Ice Cream, where they serve ice cream in miniature coffins.
Oh, yes, please.
Which you can recycle if you have, like, a recently deceased family gerbil, presumably. But my world's worst vacation is to... It's quite a famous... Do you know what the famous place? Do you know what the Four Corners Monument is?
Oh, it's the Four Corners where you can look at four different states at the same time.
Yeah, so it's a... You know the bit in, like, the western bit of America where there's loads of square... straight lines and squared off states. Basically, the point where Arizona, Colorado, New Mexico, and Utah meet, there is a point, which I'm about to talk about, where apparently you can stand in all four states at the same time. So this is at a place called Shiprock. Now, a lot of this territory is owned by the Navajo Nation, by the way, and Shiprock is an actual large rocky outcrop. But this there's a town called Shiprock as well, which has a crosshairs on a giant brass plaque that you can stand on, which has a little, you know, this cross, which has New Mexico, Colorado, Utah, and Arizona named. And there you can find photos all over the internet of people with, like, a hand in two of them and a leg in two of them. And it's, you know, thousands of people every year go to this place in the middle of the desert where it's very sweaty, very sweaty to have their photo taken. And it's in the wrong place.
Oh, no.
Apparently, according to locals, the right place is about 600 metres away. It's not where the plaque is, just in a convenient place. But they have surveyed the area again and again and again. So I think this is the place this plaque has been for ages. But not only is it in the wrong place, but it's not even the point where all four of the states meet anyway, because tribal land, if you like, is considered sovereign. So if you look at a map of the United States, like, with the tribal lands marked in, you can see... the Navajo Nation own a large swathe, which basically cuts into where that this point of these four states meeting would be. So it's not actually the meeting point of four states at all. It's tribal land and the plaque's in the wrong place, even if it was.
You know, I was actually looking at this today.
Were you?
And I saw this map of the Navajo land, and I remarked to myself, wow, that is a very distinct state. I can see why people want to visit it. It's very right angled.
Yes, very easy to get around. Yeah, if people want to look up the Wikipedia article on tribal nation sovereignty, they can find one of those maps which has, you know, a white patch which spans the entirety of the Four Corners Monument. So I'm sure it's not the only such place, but as misnomers go, having your plaque in the wrong place and it not even being the meeting point of four states anyway seems pretty bad to me. So I'm going to go with the Four Corners Monument. So, our candidates this week for the world's worst vacation are Ben's suggestion of the Flat Earth International Conference's cruise to the ends of the Earth, a trip that'll have you on the edge of your seat, if not your planet. Ashraf's suggestion of the floating petri dish that was the Diamond Princess cruise. And my suggestion of the angularly inaccurate Four Corners Monument. And I get to be the judge of this. I'm going to, you know, the Four Corners Monument seems not important enough. So I'm gonna discard my own suggestion. I think there are better cases to be made for coronavirus on sea. which is very topical and absolutely a horrifying situation to find yourself. And yet, Ashraf, I think we have found a worse cruise than
I think so too. I would have to agree. A cruise that would never end.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes!
They only had an extra 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And not only that, they did get to do, as you said, most of their cruise before coronavirus struck. Whereas coronavirus didn't allow our Flat Earth cruise to even happen. It's a double tragedy in many ways. So congratulations, Ben. I am going to pick the Flat Earth Society cruise.
Possibly the first time they've been victorious.
I don't think they won in previous appearances on the show, so well done, lads. We'll send you a certificate, which will be obviously in the shape of a sphere. Before we go, very quickly, I've got to give you some of the best news of the week. During lockdown, we've been drifting away from telling you bad news and telling you some good news instead. And this, I'm sure you guys will have seen this, this is from today, where the British government was forced to do a U-turn by footballer Marcus Rashford. Marcus Rashford, who's a striker for Manchester United, has been doing a lot of work raising money to help fund food and school meals and stuff for kids. Because he said growing up, he relied on free school meals a lot. And the government had announced an end to their voucher scheme to provide school meals during lockdown, and Marcus Rashford wrote a very eloquent 2-page letter to the Prime Minister asking him to extend the scheme. Boris Johnson basically didn't answer it, or the spokesman for Number 10 just said, the government will be doing lots of stuff to help kids. And like, no, but what about the scheme? We're also doing lots of other stuff to help kids. 1.3 million children apparently were relying on it. And within hours of Number 10 saying that they weren't going to do it, and Labour were going to force a vote on the issue in the House of Commons, the Prime Minister announced they'd suddenly found 120 million quid down the back of the sofa for a COVID summer food fund. Putting aside the right-wing commentators on the internet who are going, but this footballer could probably pay for all of these kids to eat themselves, which, overlooking what, you know, the job of a government and a taxation system is. Yes, I thought it was great to see somebody using their platform, and a much maligned group of people, I would say, footballers, mm-hmm. using his platform for good. Isn't it mad that we live in a world where Gary Neville is an authority on trying to stamp out racism in football, and Marcus Rashford is apparently the Minister for Education?
Yeah, well, listen, Sir Alex Ferguson is the greatest Labour leader we never had. And can I congratulate you on the magnanimity of you, a Liverpool fan, at taking your hat off to Marcus Rashford, a Man United forward?
Very, very difficult. I'm just hoping he eats enough of those meals that he's not able to run very fast when he plays against us next. Ashraf, before we go, where can people find you on the internets?
Well, they can find me on Instagram at ashraf.ej to see, you know, my ramblings or various selfies in the sunlight.
you take a good selfie.
Not much else going on now.
Excellent. And meanwhile, we're all off to try and get a pedalo and see if we can row to the ends of the earth. Maybe put Ben on the front of the prow as our figurehead. Thank you for listening to Worst Foot Forward. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye. Thank you.